The Education Gadfly Show starts now.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my co-host, hopping mad that China still refuses to let the yuan float freely in world markets, Rick Hess. Welcome, Rick.
Hey, Mike. Actually, you could have some fun with this. You know, Mexico could rename its currency the U Carlos.
Ooh.
France could rename its little piece of the Euro pie the U Pierre.
Ooh.
There's a lot of naming things that you could do. The Chinese are foresightful this way.
But you know, it's yuan. I mean, are there people in China named Yuan? Is that what you're saying?
That would be cool.
Okay. So, Rick, looks like Jimmy Carter has gotten himself into some trouble again with his new book. This is Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid.
That's a strange title for a book.
You know, some people think he's even plagiarized, and some people even accuse him of anti-Semitism. So, what do you think? Should we get him on the show to explain himself?
Does any of this have anything to do with education?
Oh, right. Well, that's a good question. Okay, right. Good point.
I'm just asking. It does.
And actually, speaking of interviews, I want you to know, listeners, that we did get a note this week from one of our listeners who said, you know, he was a little upset that we keep doing fake interviews.
We do fake interviews?
Well, you know, we had Judge Judy on the show last week.
How's that fake?
Well, it wasn't really Judge Judy, as it turns out.
Who was it?
We weren't going to tell you, Rick. We didn't want to disappoint you.
Was it somebody dressed up as Judge Judy?
It's, you know, a little technology, a little technological sleight of hand.
It was Sandra Day O'Connor.
Exactly.
Playing herself off as Judge Judy.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So we have a commitment to provide real live interview guests most of the time from now on.
Way to lay down a marker, big
That's
guy.
Right. Including this week, we are doing a real live interview with Graham Down, who used to run the Council for Basic Education, talking about our big Fordham Conference on the Liberal Arts. So you can look forward to that.
Who runs the CBE now, Mike?
Well, that's the issue, is that it has gone defunct.
So we have our big treat is an interview with the former head of a defunct organization?
That is correct.
Whoa. And stay tuned, listeners.
And Rick, that's why you have not gone into marketing. Now, don't worry. If anybody knows Graham Down, you know he is a delightful man with a lot of interesting things to say. And I want you to know that his organization was going strong when he left the presidency back, I don't know, 15 years ago. So, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know, well, I don't know what it's like. Blaming Ronald Reagan for something that George W. Bush did. That's kind of like what it's like.
Okay.
All right. There we go. So if you have any other comments, listeners, suggestions, or just funny things to tell us about, send us a letter, letters@edexcellence.net. You can also put a comment on the Education Gadfly website. That's exciting, and everybody can see that. So we're going to start with Pardon the Gadfly. We'll do our interview that Rick has promoted so well. And then our in-house weirdo, Liam, will leaven our mood with some education news of the weird fermentation.
Huh.
So let's play Pardon the Gadfly. Three debate topics, 90 seconds each. Jen, take it away.
All right. Pledge of Allegiance is back in the news. According to the Christian Science Monitor, many students, even those in states that require the pledge, aren't learning it and aren't saying it. Should we care?
Now, I mean, personally, I was a little unclear on exactly what authoritative sources of evidence the Christian Science Monitor was using to make this argument. Anybody want to enlighten me? Did they see more in the article than I saw?
You researchers. So the article does say that 40 states require the pledge to be spoken. Of course, students can opt out. The Supreme Court's made that clear. But the schools are required to do the Pledge of Allegiance. I'm curious, Rick. You're usually Libertarian.
But the evidence that people aren't saying it is some curmudgeon professor from a Boston school.
Yes,
that's it.
Yes.
Okay.
And speculating that people in their 20s and 30s don't really know how to say the pledge.
But without any evidence.
Well, actually, let's test that, Rick.
Okay.
You're in your 30s. Can you go ahead and say the Pledge of Allegiance for our audience?
Wow. You're springing that on me, baby. You're springing that. No, probably not. I don't think I could pull it off.
You can't pull it off?
I don't know. It's been a long time.
Rick. Well, that's exactly the point. Now, but you're Mr. Libertarian. You always say that schools shouldn't have all these regulations mandated on them. So is this one of them? Should we get rid of these mandates?
Nah, this isn't a mandate. The shame is that it's 40 states instead of 50.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's something, you know, particularly the extent that folks on the right and left generally agree that one of the important jobs for schools is to maintain some notion of a unified civic culture,
right?
Whether you do that through different kinds of schools or state-run schools is the argument. we all agree that kids need to be Americans, and it strikes me that one of the minimal thresholds is it's okay to have kids wake up every morning and, you know, say that they pledge allegiance to this nation they live in.
Very interesting.
You feel otherwise, baby?
I'm just surprised that Mr. Libertarian is willing to...
I'm no libertarian.
Okay. All right. Well, there you have it.
That's...
We'll talk about those American flag mandates next week.
Ooh, the flag.
Yes.
I like the flag.
Number two.
All right. Topic two. The Wall Street Journal's Stephen Moore writes about a group of 4,000 non-union teachers in Washington State who are suing the Washington Education Agency. The teachers claim that WEA is, without permission, using cash from their paychecks to support political goals with which the teachers don't agree. One wonders why non-union members have cash withheld from their paychecks in the first place. Rick, what's the deal?
And the deal with the Washington Education Association, I believe we're talking about, the teachers' union.
As opposed to which deal?
The Washington Education Agency.
I'm like Ron Burgundy. I just read what's in front of me.
That's right. Note to our writers. Yes, yes, yes. All right.
Oh, that's right. Remember that when Burgundy pulled that off? Oh, that was ugly.
That was ugly.
Look, the deal's real simple. The problem with the reason you have this kind of involuntary contribution to unions is because if you don't have it, everybody can free ride. Whichever members of the unions there are winds up negotiating these contracts and collective bargaining states. It sets a wage scale, which everybody who's a teacher benefits from, whether or not they are party to the negotiations. So there's a concern that you actually unravel any effort at collective representation because people can free ride. The flip side of this, of course, is two hugely negative things. One, you're confiscating people's money to support an organization that they may not have any sympathy with. And it becomes particularly problematic when their money is being used not just for nuts and bolts negotiation on their behalf, but being used to push a political agenda they might not buy into.
So why can't these teachers totally opt out not only of the union, but also of all of the single salary schedules and everything else? Let these other teachers negotiate their own salaries with their own principal.
Well, I mean, right, the notion of a collective bargaining state is that if you vote to be represented by an entity, that everybody actually benefits from whatever, you know, prevailing wages that entity negotiates.
Okay. So that's basically what a closed shop is all about.
Right. So, I mean, what we could do is you could change the state statutes on the books, right? But that's different from what Stephen Moore was talking about in this piece.
You know, Rick, I mean, to me, this makes common sense that, of course, teachers that don't believe in a certain political advocacy shouldn't have to pay for it. And yet our friends, you know, a lot of our friends in center left just go ballistic when you raise this idea of paycheck protection, like we're some crazy right-wing Nazis to even bring up the idea.
That's right. And I mean, the fact is, look, you can sympathize with the notion that they have to help pay for the nuts and bolts of the representation, but that's a whole different ballgame from them being able to have money confiscated to propose a political agenda that they might not sign off on.
Okay. Number three, Jen.
All right. Our final topic. A new Education Week study says Bill Gates is the most influential man in American education. Do we believe this?
Michael?
Rick, you came in a strong second, I understand.
Boom, baby!
There you go. Ho!
Boom.
Actually, I think there's some truth to it. I know that you're at times not a big Bill Gates fan, and I'm not a fan of everything that foundation has done. But, you know, they have more discretionary money than the Department of Education. They have had a huge influence, in many ways not very good influence, especially in our big urban districts. So I think it's true.
Yeah. And what's amazing is he did all this with one speech. If he had given a second speech, he might have been named King of the Universe or something.
That's right. That's right. Well, but seriously, Rick, it really is the money, right? I mean, every big city school district in this country has embraced the Gates agenda. And in some respects, that agenda is not going very well.
Well, and I mean, what's funny is, of course, as that agenda has evolved, they've embraced whatever the current iteration is because, right. You know, when there's a really large – you know, train leading the station. You jump on whatever the train that is.
All right. Now let's talk about the rest of this study. It was about influential people and organizations and information sources. Some interesting things came out. So Bill Gates is number one. Eli Broad, not on the list at all. Pretty interesting. You look at information sources.
I think there's some PR people who are going to be getting
to it. I was going to say, I think the people at the Broad Foundation in LA are not going to be happy with this news. You look at information sources. Phi Delta Kappa, not on the list.
Whoa.
Education Next, a fine publication that we happen to be associated with, made the list.
Ed Next made the list. Is this the story? Look at that.
Made the list.
Look at that.
The Kappan did not.
Look at that.
I am a little upset that the Gadfly got beat by the Penn News Blast.
Oof. Oof, yeah. That's painful. Did the Gadfly make it?
The Gadfly made it. And what about the AEI Education newsletter? Wait, you guys don't even have one.
Oh, yeah, baby. Well, at least that makes being left off the list less embarrassing. Our good buddy Edgewonk made the list too, didn't he?
It did. It did indeed.
With you know, only minimal resources run out of Andy's laptop from the back porch in Charlottesville.
That's right.
Shows what modern technology has wrought.
It's going to make all those other education journals feel a little bit sad.
That's true. Think about all the money they put in and they get beat by the Penn Newsblast.
That's right. I know. Well, that is it for Part in the Gadfly. Thank you, Jen. Thank you, Rick. We now turn to this week's interview, a much ballyhooed interview, with the esteemed, elegant, and effervescent Graham Down. Let's take a listen. Just the other day, Fordham sponsored a big conference on the narrowing of the curriculum. We looked at why this might be happening, what we can do about it, why it's important for every child in this country to get a broad liberal arts education. And really, the inspiration for that conference was the former president of the Council for Basic Education, Graham Down. And Graham is with us today. Graham, welcome to the Education Gadfly Show.
Thank you very much indeed.
So, Graham, we spent the day on Tuesday talking a lot about the various arguments for the liberal arts and K-12 education, why every child should get this kind of education. What do you think is the most compelling argument, or at least the most saleable argument to the American people?
I would think that in this era of interdependent globalization, it's absolutely imperative for American students to know as much in terms of content of the basic subjects, if not more than other highly developed countries. At the moment, we're in the middle of the pack. No matter how you evaluate international comparisons, and I realize they're not foolproof, but we know that we've had enough of them, especially the third TIMSS test, to corroborate what I'm saying, that we're in the middle rather than the top of the pack. And I believe that that is a very poor omen for our future of our economy and the future of our whole way of life.
Right. But those tests are mostly of math and reading and science. And so some people might argue we should just focus on those subjects and to heck with history or literature or certainly the arts or music. I mean, why is it that you think we can make the case that those subjects are important too?
Well, the importance of the arts is that they are without question the finest motivator of student activity and student conviction and student intellectual growth. I mean, they're dynamite in terms of transforming the atmosphere of a school, the intellectual atmosphere of a school. In terms of the humanities are what bind us together, what binds societies together, what binds the world together. Languages, the importance of having every student doing a second language is so implicit as a part of the liberal arts formula, and that didn't quite get the hearing I hoped it might on Tuesday.
And it's still a hard argument to make, I think, to American people and to the school boards around the country that those skills and that knowledge is important. Let me ask you about an interesting dynamic that happened at the conference. It seemed like the group was split in two, some people wanting to blame No Child Left Behind or at least state accountability systems for narrowing the curriculum, you know, because what gets tested gets taught. People worried that we're just testing in math and reading in many places, then that's a problem. Other people saying that no, it's that schools are responding to those pressures in idiotic ways by getting rid of all the other subjects, and that, in fact, if you want your reading scores to go up, you should teach content, teach history, teach science. Where do you come down on that debate?
No question, if you want reading scores to go up, you teach content. You teach reading for understanding, not reading as a desiccated list of words that you either memorize or don't have in your vocabulary.
Okay, but then why are all these principals, Graham, not doing that? Why do they think that if they drill and kill, they're going to get better results?
Partly because one of the most influential of the reading organizations, the IRA, has only recently come to terms with the fact that they were frankly wrong and that reading is much best taught through literature than through any other means. And, you know, if, as somebody once observed, I believe it was Clemenceau, it's easier to frequently to move a graveyard than to change a curriculum. So principals are given to what they learned when they were at ed school 20 years ago, 30 years ago. That's part of the reason for the innate conservatism of public education.
Right. And didn't you also say at the meeting that a fish rots from the head? Can you explain that? What does that mean, Graham?
People can't set a tone, a culture in a school and encourage teachers to think of themselves as continuous learners. And very few principals have even thought about that notion, let alone knowing how to establish a culture which favors that exchange of ideas which is central to the liberal arts.
What does that have to do with the fish rotting, though?
I beg your pardon?
But the fish rotting from the head, you mean that's the principle is the head. Is that what you're saying?
That's precisely.
Right.
If the principle isn't instructionally minded, you can't possibly establish an atmosphere that's conducive to academic excellence.
Right. All right. Well, one more question, Graham. Undoubtedly, when you look around the room the other day, I think the average age was about 57. One person said to me that the room was stale and male. How do we get this this idea of the liberal arts in K-12 education, how do we get the younger generation excited about it, especially when many people in my generation, and I'm including myself here, did not get this kind of education ourselves?
Well, I think we must abandon the notion that the only way to teach the liberal arts is for teachers to talk. Great teachers ask questions. Great teachers motivate students by having students active learners, not passively inert like receptacles, to be filled with desiccated information. We must use the computer and use technology and use the media as a way of transforming perhaps the role of the teacher so the teacher becomes a facilitator and students take an active part in their own instruction.
Excellent. Okay, Graham. Well, lots for us to think about. Again, we appreciate all of your involvement in this issue over the years, being the inspiration for our conference and for coming on the show. So, Graham Down, thanks for joining the Education Gadfly Show.
I enjoyed every moment of it, and thank you, Michael. We'll talk soon, I hope. Goodbye.
So what do you think about this, Rick? Why is it that so few people in our generation are advocates for liberal arts? I mean, you go to a charter school conference, there's all kinds of enthusiasm, young people. You go to a liberal arts conference, and frankly, most people are older, and there's not the same energy. What's up with that?
That's an interesting kind of – an interesting thesis. Do we know that that's actually accurate?
Well, anecdotally, I have a hard time thinking of people that are in our – you know, that are in their 20s or 30s or even 40s that are out there, you know, being very strong on some of these curricular issues. Whereas, you know, you go to some of these charter school gatherings, new schools, venture fund, you look at what's happening with KIPP and, you know.
That's true. Now, I mean, there is an interesting question here of whether this is kind of a cohort or a generational effect, right?
Yeah.
So that you think you roll it back a generation. There's a question, were there a lot of folks in their late 20s and 30s at that point talking curriculum?
Right.
Or is curriculum inevitably kind of an eminence grease kind of game?
Yeah. Well, this is
– I don't know what the answer is.
That's a reasonable question. So.
Actually, I do – one thing that does strike me is that the Council of Basic Education was unfortunately named.
It was very unfortunately named.
Because it turns out that its agenda wasn't really about basic education.
Right.
It was about liberal education.
Exactly.
They're deceptive on this front.
That's right. And perhaps that's why it fell apart.
Boom.
All right. Well, it is now everyone's favorite time, Education News of the Weird, with our special correspondent, Liam Julian. Liam, you got something special for us this week?
Mike, all Stephen Mermer, a high school art teacher in Richmond, Virginia, wants is to be able to paint pictures with his butt and genitals. And the fascists at Monacan High School won't let him. Mermer, who is working with the ACLU to rectify the situation.
Rectify.
Was suspended with pay for 5 days and could face further punishment because of his private part art, which he makes by smearing his aforementioned body parts with paint and pressing them against a canvas.
You know, that blogger a few weeks ago that said that we giggle like fraternity boys on this show, I don't know what they were talking about.
Mermer went to great lengths to protect his private life, too. He used an artist pseudonym, and he also wore disguises whenever appearing with his art in public. Students at Monacan High School called the suspension, quote, stupid and ignorant, unquote. Mermer's most popular piece, Tulip Butts, can be purchased for $600 on his website, www.buttprintart.com. Rick, shouldn't the value of butt art be determined by the relative beauty of the butt making the art?
Oh, man. Now, that is an aesthetic question. Who's going to set the standard for beauty for the typical butt?
The thing is that in the New York Times Magazine last week, one of the great ideas was tishology. Apparently, there is a scientist who's come up with this formula for measuring the beauty of behind.
Really?
Yeah. Should check it out.
I should definitely check
it out. And how would this teacher do on that?
I got to say.
Well, that's the thing. That's what I'm wondering. I mean, $600, it just doesn't seem right.
$600 actually seems a little low. When you can just throw some buckets of paint on the canvas and get 40 or 50K, the notion that you actually have to paint your butt and your genitalia, you know, blue or red, and then sit on a canvas. And you're only getting $600 for this?
And in terms of cleaning up afterwards, are paint thinners involved? How does that work?
And turpentine?
Right.
I mean, I just – there's some places turpentine does not go in.
That's exactly you know. Right. You know, but I have some sympathy for this guy. I mean, he went out of his way to use a pseudonym to you know, make sure that there was a clear distinction between his art and his work in the school.
He disguised his painting part.
I know. So I just think it's a little bit unfair for the school to, you know, to give him a hard time about this.
Especially if it was a magnet, they could actually leverage it.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't know. He could probably do some murals around school.
It could, they could be the, you know, they could be the magnet for the butt art.
That's...
I mean, talk about...
What segment of the population would that appeal to?
Well, we're always trying to come up with... You know, interesting specialties so that students will want to cross class and race lines and go to a school. Something like, you know, the school for the hospital sciences or the school for advertising. To me, that doesn't really resonate. I think you could actually appeal to a whole lot of kids from diverse orientations if they could go to the school for the butt arts.
Well, you heard it here first. If the Supreme Court strikes down these desegregation programs.
Jefferson County is coming.
That's right. I think the school for the butt arts magnet school program is another way to get to that kind of diversity.
That's what I'm talking about.
All right. Well, that is thankfully all the time we have for this week. Liam, thank you for coming up for that incredibly weird news. Of the weird. Don't forget to read the original Education Gadfly at edexcellence.net. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.